Good morning, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes. Today I am joined, as always, pretty much, by Connor.
Hey, good morning. Not always, but, you know, a lot of
most frequently. I think it's most likely if I'm joined by anybody, I'm probably joined by you. I think this is a bread and butter Lopes on Movies, you know. This is
Lopes's. Yes, it's a true Lopes on Movies.
Very, very much so. Very much so. It's not a Lopes on Movies where I'm going to be able to recommend great movies to go see in theaters, unfortunately, because I don't remember the last time that I stepped foot in a movie theater. It was certainly many decades ago.
No,
it was probably for... God, was it really for Top Gun Maverick? It very well might have been. I can't remember anything else that came out in between Top Gun Maverick and right now.
Well, there's a few things. Some things that are not available.
So here's the problem, right? So I was talking with our resident radio man Steve Kramark earlier today, and I was like, yeah, I know I need to get to the theater, but there's nothing I want to see that's available to see in Delaware. There's plenty of stuff I want to see. You know, he gave me one of those like, oh yeah, because the movies you want to see are those like, you know, weirdo movies. I'm like,
what a way to say it.
Okay. Which was then followed by the student next to me saying that he just saw Black Adam. He didn't have any strong opinions on it. He said, yeah, that was an interesting, it was interesting. He's also going to go to the One Piece movie, which was much more funny to me to hear that one.
But we're going to go to the One Piece movie. That's 100% getting seen.
All these anime movies, man, they just...
It's crazy how that's getting a really wide release.
I know. Everybody wants to see these anime movies.
Yeah. I haven't watched One Piece since it's like original, like... What, did Four Kids do the dub of that? And then they
did on Toonami back when we were kids.
Right.
It's actually really funny because the generation of people that are watching One Piece now, like the people who are in college now watching One Piece, have no recollection of that version of One Piece. They only ever watch it from the sub. So like, I had the pleasure of introducing this person to the One Piece rap. If you remember the intro song from
how
the Four
could you
Kids,
not? That was the best
to
part.
To me, it's iconic, you know. But like, there is a whole generation of people who watch that show who are completely unfamiliar with the One Piece rap, which I think is just utterly insane.
I mean, they like it, right?
Once you see that,
you're like, oh man,
they love it immediately. But it's you know, it just makes me feel very old that it's possible for people to be One Piece fans and not know the One Piece rap. But of course, we're talking about anime, which is something that we try not to do on this show because we don't want to, you know, make everybody turn off their radios. We should probably talk about some movies, even if it's not necessarily movies in theaters that you can see in Delaware right now, but maybe some movies you could see in a month in Delaware.
I don't know. Well, hold on. I got a movie you can see now that I saw with my beautiful girlfriend yesterday because it was her turn to pick the movie.
So this movie is one that is widely available. What's it called?
Ticket to Paradise.
Ticket to Paradise. Oh, this is that Julia Roberts and
George Clooney
movie, right?
Yeah.
They're back. It's a classic, you know, 90s rom-com, except with the same people, just, you know, 30 years later. It's that's the bit, right? Or at least that's how they were selling it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's the bit. Yeah, it's that's what it is. Yeah, so it's about a divorced couple who's Julia Roberts and George Clooney, who are, you know, who hate each other now, and we find out like how their marriage kind of falls apart throughout the movie. But they have to go on a trip to Bali to try to prevent their daughter from marrying one of the locals there for what they think is like rushing to a marriage and ruining her life like they did with their relationship. So they're banded together to try to stop her from marrying this very nice guy the daughter just met.
Okay. Yeah, you know, that sounds like a premise. I'm sure that there's, you know, feelings get reignited.
Yes.
You know, all this beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
I sound like I'm making fun of it. I got nothing against a little story like that. I don't know if it's any good though. What do you think?
It's fine. Like, I don't know. It was, the performances are really good. You know, George Clooney and Julia Roberts are both fantastic.
Yeah. Used to
actors.
Be huge movie stars. You know?
Yeah, it's just and you know, I think they took this one because it was a beautiful vacation to Bali. They had a great time doing it. It seemed like didn't require a lot of work. After the movie, when they did the making of scenes and like the blooper reel, that remember when movies
used
to
did
do
a
the
blooper reel? Wow!
It looked like they had a lot of fun doing it.
Well, I'm happy for them. I'm glad they had a good time. You know, I like to have a good time in my life, so it makes me happy when I see multi-million-dollar celebrities having a good time in Bali. That's all I ever want to see. So I'm happy for them. You know, that's great. So I guess you could see that if you know, you're really starving for something to see in theaters. The movie I want to see is called Decision to Leave. It's a Korean film.
Which, of course, I've also already
seen. You've already seen it, but I don't want you to talk about it because I want to see it. I've been seeing so much about that movie on Twitter and for like months, and it's killing me that I can't go to see it because it's like everybody's describing it as like, it's Park Chan-wook, right?
Yes.
And everybody always talks about how influenced by Hitchcock he is. And obviously, I'm a huge Hitchcock guy. I love Hitchcock
movies. Of course. There's some Hitchcock in the movie.
Well, that's what they're saying. You know, people are saying it's, you know, it feels, you know, kind of Hitchcockian in a way. And it's like, I'll be the judge of that, sure. But
I'll give you a little preview. It's not like outwardly. It's definitely his own. If you've seen movies from Park Chan-wook before.
He directed Old Boy. Directed The Handmaiden.
But he's got his unique style to it.
Sure.
That's definitely in this. Can I just talk about, all right, I won't. But no. We gotta leave it.
I don't want to know anything about it before I see it, other than, you know, I know the premise, sort of, and that's all I want to know. I'm very excited to see it. Seems like it's right up my alley. Maybe I'll be able to see it in like a month whenever it finally shows up in like maybe one theater in Delaware, if we're lucky. Oh, man, it breaks my heart. But then again, that's the same thing happened with Parasite, however many years ago that was, where I heard about it for months before I was actually able to see it. But, you know, what can you do? Instead, we're going to talk about a real Hitchcock movie because, you know, why not? You know, we've done that before. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do on this show, and a thing that I love to do because, you know, I never get tired of talking about Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, so we talked a little bit about, like, earlier this month, about how they were doing some screenings of Hitchcock movies in New York for Hitchcocktober, they called it, if I remember correctly. And
doesn't work as well as Lynchtober like we did a few years ago.
I don't know. I think it literally has the month in there. I think it works pretty well.
No, it's actually much better.
But this movie that we're going to talk about was one of those movies that was screening. Did you go to the screening of this, or is this just something that you watched on your own?
No, you know, I'll tell you what, it was on, TCM.
You know what? I think I did see something about that. Yeah. It was on TCM recently. Yeah, because I saw it trending on Twitter, and I was like, why is this movie trending on Twitter? I don't understand. And now I understand why. It was on TCM. That's right. But yeah, this is... we're going to talk about Dial M for Murder, which is a Hitchcock movie that is not widely considered one of his best, I don't think. But as with all Hitchcock movies, all of them are interesting. All of them are valuable. I actually first saw this movie literally... I know the date. Because this was back when I first saw this movie when I was starting to log movies on Letterboxd. So the first time I saw this movie was on January 20th, 2014.
Ooh, that's a long time ago for you. Like,
yeah.
What did 2014 Joey think?
Well, so 2014 Joey made a comment about how it reminded him of like a play. Which, you know, I was wondering if maybe it was like originally like a theater thing, which apparently it was.
Yes.
So that was actually a fairly accurate observation, which, you know, whatever. And I also said something that I think is like in hindsight incredibly stupid, even though I understand why I said it. I said Hitchcock really is the master of making super simple stories super engaging, Because now when I think back on that, I was like, this story is not simple at all. This is one of the most like complex and intricate plots that you're ever going to get in a movie. And it's kind of brilliant in how unbelievably meticulously constructed it is. So I think I was just referring to the fact that it's, you know, it's about a murder plot, which is a simple like conceit, but the actual like mechanics of the story are unbelievably complex. So really in hindsight, like I think you know, I probably rated it like 3 out of 5 stars back then, but I feel like I was drastically underrating this, and I kind of love everything about it watching it now. So I don't know where you're at.
Yeah, no, 100%. I thought this was fantastic. Yeah. Do you want to give a little like blurb about it?
Yeah, I guess we can kind of get into like, the basic premise. I mean, we might like. I feel like this conversation could veer into spoilers a little bit, just because I feel like there's so much beautiful detail in this movie that it's hard to talk about without at least getting into some aspects of the plot.
Yeah,
so that may happen,
fine, though.
But the, I mean, it's this movie came out in 1954, so the statute of limitations is over, as far as I'm concerned. So this the movie is about a man who he discovers that his wife is cheating on him, basically, and he decides to come up with this plan to have her killed. But the plan doesn't quite work out, and he backpedals into instead the person that he hired to kill his wife ends up dying in the attempt of killing her. And he backpedals now and tries to frame his wife for that man's murder so that she ends up getting executed or whatever. Right. And I think the thing that's so brilliant about it is how it's every little detail of it is explained to you, to the point where you can't possibly understand how it could go wrong because it seems so perfectly thought out. And then by the end, when it does go wrong, it's like, oh, that it's such a simple thing, but it never would have occurred to me.
Yeah, exactly. That that's something, and they, you know, they do kind of foreshadow that too earlier on in the movie, mm-hmm. where they because I guess we can go into the cast now. So
sure, yeah.
The character I was going to bring up that is the. That is going to attempt to be killed, and then it kind of is getting framed. Is Grace Kelly, you know, mm-hmm. an immortal iconic actress, and mm-hmm. it's Robert Cummings who is who she's the one she's having an affair with, and he plays a mystery writer, like a suspense novelist who has like a background in particularly in like murder stories. Mm-hmm. So he kind of brings up kind of. Like subtly, like, oh, it's always something very small that that kind of like that the person who's trying to pull off a murder like messes up, and that's just like mm-hmm. a little hint at the very very early on in the movie that kind of comes back at the end. But the mm-hmm. The lead and Robert Cummings is awesome. I mean, we can talk about him too. I don't know if we did talk about Rope on the show before. I can't remember if we did or not.
I can't remember if we did, but if we didn't, Rope is awesome too.
Yeah, Rope is fantastic, and he's you know. That it's similar to Rope, but then I think the whole movie in general. But Robert Cummings was also in Saboteur, right? Wasn't he? He was the lead in that, wasn't he? I think he was, right?
I don't. Yes, he was in Saboteur. Yeah, that's right. That's so funny because Saboteur was like. I barely recognized him, yeah, but because Saboteur would have been like 12 years earlier, I think, is what it was looking at this now. Wow, but yeah, you're right, that was him. So Hitchcock brought him back.
Yeah,
in a role that I think is probably more suited for him for a Hitchcock movie, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, this is great. Saboteur. But the lead is Ray Milland.
Ray Milland,
who plays Tony, who is just the best.
He's incredible, right?
And the reason why
you want to root for him,
you want to root for a guy who's just meticulously plotting to kill his wife for the sole reason that he makes very clear, very early on, is just that he's become used to the lifestyle that he's living now with her, and he doesn't really have that much money. He kind of ended his tennis career. Early because she didn't like it, and she comes from money, so she already has money, and his thought is, well, she's gonna leave me, I'm gonna be left with nothing, so I need to get rid of her and then be able to get all the money so I can keep my lifestyle going.
It's that great combination, like he's so unbelievably cold and chilling but like very very charming, and there's just something about him that like is very interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a vintage Hitchcock performance.
But that's the thing that's like Rope, which is why I brought that up before, it's very similar in that your protagonists are also just trying to pull off, like, and get away with a murder, and something like a crime is your lead, which I think probably Hitchcock was one that did this before, like anyone where the protagonists are like these loathsome people that you actually rooting for. I mean, I know nowadays seems like that's just regular, like,
but I don't know. I think it's just so fascinating to watch these characters, and especially a character like the main character in this, that Ray Milland plays, just the calculated nature of what he's planning. Like the thing that I remembered the most from this movie, from the first time I watched it, was one of the first scenes, which is a very, very long scene, where Ray Milland calls up the person he's going to ask to kill his wife. And we get this scene where the guy comes over, and in the beginning of the scene, it's, you think that he's just calling this guy to, you know, negotiate buying a car from him. And by the end of the scene, the guy has agreed to murder his wife. And it's just this like very, very, very long scene of getting from that, from point A to point B in the most like logical and calculated way possible. It involves basically like knowing something about that guy's past and like being able to sort of blackmail him a little bit, but also offering a little bit of incentive. And then he also has the entire plot of how it's going to be done planned out. He goes through every single bit about it. This is great, like, moment where once they start going over the plan, Hitchcock, he cuts to like an overhead view of the room just so that you can like really take in the like mechanics of how this is supposed to be done. And like every single part of the plan is explained, you know, anything that could go wrong, they bring up, and he counters it with like, oh, you could do this, you know, whatever. And it's all perfectly thought out. And of course, like, you know that it's not going to go the way that it was planned, but there's just something so interesting about, like, it really is one of the greatest things in movies to me, is when you hear about a plan and then see the plan in action, and like, you know, the realities of what the plan entails start going wrong, and like they have to figure out how to work around the things that weren't working. It's just so interesting to watch all of that kind of stuff. I talked about this with Top Gun Maverick, where it's like the whole movie is like you learning about the plan of what they're going to do, and the big climax is, you know, them doing it, right? I think it's just a perfect way to make a movie. And this is like, there's multiple things in this that are like that. And the beginning is just so perfect. It gets you perfectly in the mood for like, all right, now I can't wait to see how this is going to go. And when it, of course, does go wrong, I love how Ray Milland plays it, where he's like, okay, this is now I have to salvage this somehow, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, you can just see the wheels turning in his head when he's like taking the taxi back to his house. And he's like, all right, what do I do? And eventually he figures something out, and like he almost gets away with it. But it's just like very, very small things that are set up and placed around that you wouldn't really pay attention to that end up leading to his undoing. And it's just so interesting how the movie plays all of that. And like, you don't realize it until it's finally explained to you. You sit there wondering how could he possibly not get away with this after everything that's happened? And in the end, it's like, it's just the subtlest little thing, you know, and something that you wouldn't have thought of, but makes perfect sense that it would work out that way. It really is, I think, a absolutely brilliantly written story in every capacity. I think maybe the thing that like Hitchcock people don't think of it as highly about is that it is very talky. It is very much like a stage play, in the sense that it's very, very focused on characters explaining things, as opposed to like one of Hitchcock's more like adventurous movies, I guess. But that doesn't bother me at all. And I still think that it is still very much a quintessential Hitchcock movie. I feel like, you know, it feels very much like a perfectly stylized Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I pretty much love everything about it. Like, there's so many little things that I think are just so brilliant.
I just love the pacing of it too. And it makes me think of, like, because like you said, like there's the planning stage that's going into the first part, where you hear how the plan goes, how he sets up the guy that he's going to get to murder his wife, who's someone he sort of knew back in the past, or he was a acquaintance of, I guess, loosely.
Mm-hmm. At best, yeah.
And then it kind of ends the first half of the movie after it doesn't go right. And then there's an intermission there, and it gets you like so set up for the second half of when you're like going to go into the next part, like the next act of the movie. So it does work in that sense for like your 2014 self said, like the play, you know, that you're, you have like the act break, and it makes you think that like if there was ever like a real film or film like theater culture or anything, like I think the intermission would be really cool for something like that to like be able to see the first half, like leave, and then talk to people who you're with about like what just happened in the first part, and then going into I remember thinking like, because I when you watch it on TCM or something, when the first intermission happens, it goes immediately into the second half, and I ended up feeling like you almost want to like stop and like and think.
Yeah,
about
you want
it.
The
like,
pause. Yeah,
yeah, because I think it works with the just the way it's done. It's just an example of just how it's so different now with the way that the presentation is given to you.
Yeah, totally. I definitely think like, you know, the intermission is like, they still have those in like, you know, theater. And it definitely feels like it's more of a, you know, you're going out and you're doing something kind of thing. You know, like you don't need an intermission in a movie for any particular reason. Like in theater, it makes sense for the performers to have a brief, you know, break or like to change the scenery around or do whatever they need to do. But in movies, there's no like strong reason for one, other than if like maybe it's a really long movie and you want to give the audience, you know, a chance to like get up for a second. But I think that you're right that there is just something kind of inherently nice about, you know, the break in between, especially since this movie in particular, the first part of it is like one aspect of the story. It's very like clear, and then the second part is, you know, follows up on that in a way that it does feel like two acts in a way.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I just like about movies, and, you know, we haven't talked about it yet, but we will soon. Decision to Leave does that. Where
does it?
It's like a perfect like first half of the movie, and then second half where it just works. I think I just like when things do that. I think those are just cool. Really strong movies.
It's a cool structure for sure. Yeah. You want to talk about something kind of weird with this movie?
Sure.
So this is just, you know, minutia, but I find it interesting. First thing, this movie does not have a correct aspect ratio. I don't know that anybody cares about stuff like this but me, but I think it's interesting.
Isn't there like some goofy like 3D thing or something?
Yeah, we'll talk about that too. So there's this movie was made in a transition period between the regular Academy ratio and widescreen. So it was filmed for widescreen, but it was screened in both the Academy ratio and for widescreen. So I have to imagine that Hitchcock knew that it was going to be both. So I wonder like how that informed how he like staged all of the scenes in it, because the movie was screened in like in 4x3 and, you know, approximately 16x9. Now I watched it in the widescreen version, because that's the version that's like readily available now, but I think it's interesting how, you know, there's, you know, there's technically no correct aspect ratio for this movie, at least as far as I could tell from my research. Beyond that, yes, this movie was shot in 3D and was intended to be seen in 3D, but I think that most theaters at the time, even when it came out, still mostly screened it in 2D, because 3D was kind of on the way out. Like it had its period of it of having a fad of 3D in the early 50s, I think. But this movie kind of like got the tail end of it. But yeah, I think the screening at whatever place in New York actually showed it in 3D, if I remember correctly. So I've always been curious about that, because this is actually a movie that was shot for 3D from the early 50s. I've always been just wondering what that could possibly look like. Like there's one scene in the movie that has kind of like this weird, like dreamlike imagery in it. And I always figure like, that's the scene that's the 3D scene that, you know, would have been like conceived for 3D probably. But everything else just feels like standard kind of, you know, Hitchcock filmmaking. Like I can't imagine what the 3D would have added to this story.
No,
I so it's kind of a weird one.
I don't see it. Yeah, it's this is not Avatar.
No, it is. It is certainly not Avatar.
Which I actually saw that pretty recently also.
The original Avatar?
Yeah, I saw the original Avatar. They put it back in theaters. I saw it in the 3D and everything.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I don't know. I got no strong opinions on Avatar. I saw it not in 3D. It was, you know, whatever.
Bad story, but I thought I can see why people liked it.
Yeah, you know, whatever.
You know, with the visuals and stuff.
Sure, sure. So everybody go see the sequel to Avatar, The Way of Water, coming out in December.
Yeah, you see, we finally have to say, like, it's coming out, because it actually is now.
I know, it's hard to believe, but...
The bit of it never coming out for, like, 10 years is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but you anyway, know, if you don't, actually if you don't feel see, like waiting for that.
You actually should watch Dial M for Murder, or just any Hitchcock
movie. You should. Well, yeah, I mean, Dial M for Murder is a good one to watch, and you know, just on TCM, you know, there's never a wrong time to watch a Hitchcock movie, but a movie like this is just, like... To me, it's the kind of thing that when you're finished watching it, it's kind of like, man, that was clever, you know, that was just well written, well constructed, well acted. Everything about it is just masterful.
And how great is the way Hitchcock ends movies too? And this one was just so great, also.
Oh, I love the ending of this movie so much. It's so good. Oh man, it's just so matter of fact. It's just like, well, all right. Yep. you don't have to spoil the ending, I guess. It's just, I think this is not a super long movie. I think it's like an hour 40, something like that. Give it a watch. You'll love it. Unless you have bad taste, in which case you won't. But you have good taste if you're listening to this show. I know that. You know, our listeners are movie people. That I know for sure. So watch Dial M for Murder. You'll have a great time. And we'll see you next week.